Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 180. Science Faction, the Carboniferous Period.
Sounds like a fun way for the oil companies to get people to be pro-carbon. Like, develop more fun vocabulary.
Maybe, and it does have some interesting relations to fossil fuel. If you guys haven't been following recently, we are going over the different geological periods in our intro bit. The Carboniferous Period spans 60 million years from the end of the Devonian, which we covered last week, 359 million years ago, to the beginning of the Permian Period, 298 million years ago. The name Carboniferous means coal-bearing because this is actually the period of time that gives us most of the coal that we burn today.
But did you guys start like at the...
We started at the beginning.
4 billion years ago?
Yes, 4. It has been
yeah.
Wow, it's been a while.
Well, back then, there's not a lot of periods, so you have to go like to eras and
really,
stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
really
been
long.
It's been a lot of during this time period, nothing happened.
Yeah, that's a lot of the beginning part. Almost nothing happened. And now we start getting into more of the interesting stuff. We already talked about last week about how terrestrial life was becoming established. Terrestrial life is now well established in the Carboniferous period. Amphibians were the dominant land vertebrates. And because there was such high oxygen content in the atmosphere, this is where we see these crazy giant things, giant salamanders, giant frogs. When I say giant salamander now, there is a species of giant salamander that lives now that's like 5 feet long. It lives in Japan. These giant salamanders are like 15 feet long and will eat you.
Well, like, well, you say like salamander. Are you referring to like a newt or like some sort of teeth? Like, is it like a... Is it just so big that it'll eat you in the same way it would eat like a bug or these like savage...
They had like crocodile-looking amphibians. They had...
The big heads.
Yeah, they had arthropods. They had giant, weird-looking animals. This would look like some kind of crazy sci-fi movie if you went back there. This would be a very interesting period in time to head back into.
I'd be way more afraid of a giant toad.
With its tongue, it just gets you.
It's a ranged attack.
The large coal deposits of this period owe their existence primarily to two different factors. The first is the appearance of wood tissue and bark-bearing trees.
I got some wood tissue for you.
That's right, you do.
In my backyard.
The evolution of the wood fiber lignin and the bark sealing waxy substance suberin variously opposed different type of decaying organisms. And in fact, these trees had much more of that in there, that tough fibrous tissue. At that point, the type of microorganisms that could dissolve this, that could break it down, which is now done primarily by certain types of fungi and different bacteria, they didn't exist yet. So basically what you had is these big, tall trees. They kept growing, got super big. They fell down and died. And unlike now where that gets eaten up by microorganisms, they essentially just got covered over by swampy areas and could not be digested. And they just didn't rot. They stayed around. Eventually, that would be the basis for the carbon that would become coal millions of years later.
Was there more carbon dioxide in the air as well?
More oxygen. No, higher percentage of oxygen.
So why are the trees bigger?
There's a lot of trees. I don't necessarily know that the trees are bigger themselves. The animals, okay. The things that are respirating oxygen are bigger. But it's more like, think of what a forest would look like if every single tree that was ever grown is still in there. Like, just the dead ones are just lying down. And in this case, think of it more like a swamp where the dead ones kind of fall into kind of a murky water type stuff and get covered over. Essentially, you just have a whole bunch of spare carbon lying around that is not being eaten by microorganisms, not putting back into the bioweb, and it gets layered over and becomes the coal deposits that we now mine.
If I'm an alien and I'm prospecting Earth for like a billion years ago, starting a coal mine in the rainforest, if I were to find out that they've been contaminated with bacteria, does that just mean Earth is useless? I can't use it as my coal mine anymore.
Absolutely. Once that bacteria gets there, your coal is screwed. But you have to wait a while anyway, so that's more of a long-term investment.
With like much longer lifespan.
Not that
than us.
Well, that or like great hibernation technology.
Between the swampy environments and the lack of those fungi and bacteria that could break down that tough wood proteins, you basically have the perfect recipe for a whole bunch of coal. And if it wasn't, by the way, for the evolution later on of those fungi and bacteria, we probably have a lot more coal now. Go coal.
Cole Porter?
Cole Hauser?
How many people named Cole? Never mind. All right.
Nat King Cole?
Speaking of Nat King Cole, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist, Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
Nat King Cole, you'd be lucky to be compared to coal in your stocking.
And, of course, our scientist for the evening, Mr. Seb. Seb, welcome back. How you doing?
Pretty good. Glad to be back. It's been a while.
It has been a while. Seb, of course, is our physicist expert, which we are not going to use at all for our science articles today, but that's okay.
Totally waste him here.
Totally wasted here at the Madhouse Comedy Club along the skyline of beautiful downtown San Diego. Come on out and see Madhouse's Saturday Night Showcase. And when you're not doing that, check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to. Now, Seb, you actually have a YouTube channel that you're coming out with.
Yes, called Galileo's Telescope.
And what are you going to be covering on your YouTube channel?
Various ideas. Right now, there's more stuff on most of the video. I've only done two videos so far.
Oh, okay. So at least it has nothing to do with science.
Yeah.
No, it will. There'll be science stuff, okay. too.
And movie reviews.
Yeah. No movie reviews, no. Just sort of my
He's going to be like Lord ideas. And come up with a blog that just reviews onion rings.
I would watch a YouTube channel where Seb brutally breaks down a movie and says why it's like Seb is puts on his most critical hat and breaks down every movie.
I'm not a big enough movie buff to be able to do that.
That's what makes it so much better. You're just disgusted that you have to sit there and waste an hour and a half of your time watching Ninja Turtles 1 and then write about it. I'm busy. I got shit to do. I'm angry.
All right, and speaking of extracurricular activities, you could check out our website, www.thesciencefaction.com, for details on our upcoming debate, which will be happening this July 13th at the Kensington Club in San Diego. It's going to be free admission, so if you're interested in this debate, come on out. Those of you who have heard this before know, but if you haven't heard it yet, I have been challenged by a flat earther to debate him on the existence of a globe Earth and a heliocentric model of our solar system. Seb, you'd be a better person to debate him. You have a better background, but I feel like I can handle this one. It's not exactly heavy lifting.
I've talked to him before, and he thinks gravity is a conspiracy theory.
I've heard that as well. He thinks satellites are as well. He has a lot of those, so we're going to have an interesting discussion, I think. This will be a very interesting one. Now, a lot of people have this idea in science. I somewhat subscribe to it as well. This is something we learned in science education and science communication to the public. A lot of times for ideas like this, you don't debate them because it's like debating creationists. A lot of scientists will say, we're not going to debate them because the idea is you give legitimacy to their points by debating them. And normally, I wouldn't.
Ken Ham here.
No, Ken Ham, we're not debating you either.
No, I'm just here to say, look, Bill Nye, the science guy, made a huge mistake debating me when I wiped the floor with him in an odd debate.
That is not at all what happened.
And as somebody who is, listen, I'm a young Earth creationist, but I'm not insane. I don't believe in a flat Earth or anything. I want you to beat this guy.
Thank you, Ken. I'm glad I have your support.
But I'm just saying, don't give this asshole a platform to spread his message.
And I kind of debated back and forth whether or not I would accept this because I was actually asked by another comedian to do this for him because this guy keeps posting. Now, the one thing that kind of tipped the scales on this particular one is this isn't a guy who just believes this and does his own YouTube stuff. And
it's the only thing about his personality.
Well, that's true. I would let that go. The problem is this guy evangelizes his perspective a lot. He will go onto other people's posts, other people's ideas. He types a lot. He attacks people. He's very, very aggressive in this. And so I wanted to make sure that somebody had a counter argument out there because while
everyone's
it's true,
everyone's got a counter argument out there. That's the point.
They don't like, though.
Bounce
so,
off of them like bullets.
So trust me, I've gone and looked because I wanted to see what this guy's ideas were, what other
They're
flat earthers'
They're
ideas
all
were.
Memes.
He does argue a lot with memes. And the problem becomes a lot of people put out these ideas, and because we don't want to dignify them with a response, there is not a response to a lot of their assertions and statements. And so until there is, we can't really say that we're doing a good job of educating the public because while we might think that everybody should know there's not a flat earth and everything, there are people who aren't super well educated who, if they're seeing one side and nobody is responding to it, then there's a likelihood that they're at least going to give more credence to those bad ideas. And so I think at least somebody should stand up and say, these are bad ideas. This is why. Here's the information.
He has a picture on his profile of him standing with the head of the Flat Earth Society or Flat Earth Organization, whatever it is. But it's whatever the most prestigious group in the Flat Earth Society is. And guess how this guy looks on a scale from like Neil deGrasse Tyson to a homeless Steve Buscemi.
Right.
Like guess which this head of a quote unquote prestigious organization. Guess which side?
I'm going Buscemi.
Correct.
All right.
No, Tyson. All racist.
So anyway, if you feel like coming out to that will be free admittance July 13th at the Kensington Club in San Diego. Come on out and see how that debate goes. But even if you don't
what
make
time?
It. It'll be 9 p.m., and even if you don't make it, we will have a videotape of that we will also put on YouTube, so you can go and check out how that goes. Hopefully I don't lose. I'm a little nervous. Hopefully I don't lose.
You, Here's the thing. You will lose in that you will not convince him of anything.
Nor do I have any intention to.
The two of you are going to talk past each other the whole time.
This isn't designed to convince this man that there isn't a flat earth. This is designed to refute arguments that flat earthers have to those people who are kind of in impartial public view.
Are there any people who are
I want to show you a couple of posts because this also kind of wavered my choice to do this debate. On the post that this entire thing happened, that he was responding to, that he was getting very argumentative about, there is one person who says, I don't know. I'm not quite sure I'm a flat earther, but there is some interesting points raised on this YouTube channel, and then they go back and forth. So there are some people who are at least going, well, I don't know. They have some ideas.
Well, the thing is,
as a sufferer of Down syndrome, let me just say that this leaves a lot of questions unanswered.
But they do ask interesting questions.
Right.
Like, why does this phenomena happen?
Right.
And then you could actually answer and go, oh, that's interesting. But then they come up with an answer that just makes no sense.
Which is why it's good for those people who are looking, who aren't flat earthers, but who go, oh, that's a weird argument. I've never heard anybody refute it. It's good to have somebody refute them.
I look forward to you mopping the floor with this guy. Maybe you can have a little bit more success like I had convincing Bill Nye I was right.
I never thought I'd say this before, but thank you for your praise and encouragement, Ken Ham. All right, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, guys, article number one, where cats come from. Very interesting genetic analysis.
Aren't they just female dogs?
Yeah, I've seen that documentary, Homeward Bound. I know all about how this works.
Train run on that cat later on.
So let's give some background. So obviously, cats are spread all around the world except for Antarctica. Which, by the way, doesn't exist on a flat Earth. But
aren't they just called sea cats? And don't they hunt penguins?
That's
aren't they leopard seals?
Cats exist on 6 of 7 continents. Were spread there by human beings, but they obviously came from a wild species of cat. Now there are 5 possibilities that could be basically the parent species of cat. 5 different species that live throughout Africa, Europe, and Asia that could have been the progenitors of cats. And we weren't sure exactly where cats came from within those species, the crossbreeding, the interbreeding, what area they were located from. Because, and this is kind of one of those things that make it really hard to be a paleontologist, the skeleton of all 5 species of those cats, all 5 of those different species, is essentially indistinguishable. So you can tell...
How do they know they're different species then?
Because we have them living now. So you can go to the living cats and say, okay, we have classified these as different species, but the skeletons of them, even to this day, the wild versions, are indistinguishable.
We can tell the difference between people of different ethnicities, and they're of the same species.
Right.
Whereas we can't do the same thing with cats. Is it because all the people who are super interested in cats go into the lucrative cat lady profession?
Well, we're talking about wild cats. For domestic cats, actually, things start to change. So we know that cats were domesticated a long time ago, at least 10,000 years ago. We find them in relation to early farmers in the Levant, in the Middle East, in Turkey.
For people who perhaps are idiots or intelligently challenged, what does Levant mean?
The Eastern Mediterranean.
Oh, okay. I thought it was when they... had to take the baby
Israel,
out of
my mother's. Lebanon, okay. Near East.
And so we wanted to know which of these 5 species the domestic cats came from and where they were domesticated. So what they did is they did a genetic study. Now you might say, well, you just look at a whole bunch of different cats, right, and figure out which one they match to. The hard part of that is there's a lot of current interbreeding and interbreeding that's gone on over the past few hundred years. So it's hard to just genetically analyze cats as they currently exist and figure out where everything came from. So what they did is they analyzed the skeletons of cats dating back 9,000 years. And what they found is, indeed, there was...
Is that from their first life or their last death? Like how...
Some of these cats, they're the original cat from 9,000 years ago.
Jesus Christ.
One life every 1,000 years.
Yeah, that's basically. They're Highlander cats.
They live almost as long as those aliens from earlier in the...
So they found that one single subspecies, Felis sylvestris libic, around 10,000 years ago, was the origin of all these cats.
Sylvestris?
Yeah.
Actually named Sylvester?
Yep.
He was the first cat.
Sylvester the cat is a real scientific theory.
He was killed by a Mexican, speeding Mexican mouse.
Was undoubtedly domesticated in that kind of Turkey, Levant region because that was where farming came from. Those people very much benefited from having cats around to kill the rodents that came after their grain stores. So that is probably how that domestication happens. Now, we should stop and say the domestication of cats is actually fairly unique. Most domesticated species have a very different lifestyle than cats. If you were to look at cats and pull them randomly, the natural cat, so to speak, out of a group of animal populations, they'd be very unlikely to be domesticated. Domesticated animals are almost always herd animals or pack animals. That allows us to then become kind of the head of the pack and be able to domesticate them. They have to be social species, which cats are not. They have to have a lot of qualities that cats don't have. The thing that happened likely was these cats were living on the periphery of these farming communities. They would see the abundance of rodents, come in and kill those rodents. The farmers got smart and realized, fuck, we want them here, so they didn't kill the cats. They got closer and closer in proximity until at times when there weren't enough rodents, maybe the farmers fed the cats because they were so important. They were willing to give up some of their food.
Wait, they fed them rodents? I mean, like, couldn't they just catch the rodents themselves?
Or milk for pastoralists and stuff. But they would feed them and then keep them alive, and then eventually the cats became integrated in and became domesticated. Now, that's a fair, like I said, fairly unique story in the history of domestication of domesticated animals. But now we know kind of how it happened, where it happened, what subspecies it happened to. It might have actually happened twice, because that subspecies also exists in Egypt. So it could be that it happened in the North African Egypt region, or it could be that cats were imported from Turkey, Middle East area into Egypt, and then a separate group formed in Egypt, because there is basically a definitive domesticated Egyptian cat that is, since the domestication, has become separated a little bit from those other cats, and we can tell their skeletons. So we can look at a domesticated Egyptian cat and say, oh, this is a domesticated Egyptian cat, and tell it from other domesticated cats, which is kind of the opposite of what we talked about before, where the wild cats, even though they were in five different subspecies, all had the same skeleton.
Is that specific kind of cat is maybe just like the top of the cat hierarchy, because the Egyptians liked that cat and all the other cats were like at the bottom. Nobody put them in their graves with them or anything.
Maybe, but then they exported this and we found these Egyptian domesticated cats as far away as Viking settlements in the Baltic. So you can see kind of how this became very prominent. Now, you instantly can understand why. Think of their use, especially in Egypt. Egypt's a port area, right? So you have a whole bunch of ships coming in, a lot of trading going on. What happens with grain ships? Infestation with rodents. What's the easiest way to solve that? Toss a cat on your boat. Now that cat goes to the new place, it, you know, now lives there, and you have a cat population wherever that moves to. So cats spread really far, really fast because of their usefulness to early farmer civilizations.
I have a hypothetical question. I know you're not a big fan of cats, Bobby.
Right.
But let's just say you wanted to fill this niche. You need to protect grain stores. Uh-huh. Would you have selected a different animal that kills rats?
Right.
And would be more domesticatable, less toxoplasmosis-y.
Like, okay, yeah, domesticate cobras. There you go. And then you just throw a cobra on the boat.
But they also eat your infants.
Okay, all right. Domesticate rattlesnakes.
Okay. But I mean, I've seen enough.
Hey, those are New World. Damn it. Okay.
I've seen enough mice kill a snake. I feel like you're going to need something warm-blooded.
Snakes and humans are natural predators.
Natural enemies?
Natural enemies, yeah.
Yeah, I guess, but I mean,
they're our most dominant predator throughout evolution.
I don't know how you can say that, knowing full well the Amazonian anaconda saddle that have allowed those natives to travel throughout the South America.
I was really hoping you'd say like badger or something, like some
mongoose. Yeah. The fact that they're solitary animals, that's probably why we still have prickly relations with them, even though they've been domesticated by humans for 10,000 years. It would be funny if you actually domesticated like a larger version of a rat. You know, you're like, I've got King Rat. I'm going to domesticate him and train him to kill the other rats.
It is funny because cats are like not fully domesticated in a sense.
Right. They go off and they can become feral really easy.
Some of them are really friendly, but some of them are just, they're just there because there's food. And if food was somewhere else, they'd leave. They don't care.
And they'll eat your eyes out 10 minutes after you die.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cats, I just don't understand how somebody could have this little like 10-pound biological blender in their house. That this 10-pound, I am a 250-pound man who's terrified of a 10-pound animal.
It's a good replacement for a man when you're really lonely.
That's true.
Huge dicks.
Other interesting fact about this study, what it revealed was almost all the cats for that 10,000-year history, basically up to less than 1,000 years ago, were of a striped pattern. So you've seen striped cat, they kind of look like tigers and stuff.
Aren't they female? Like, didn't we learn on an episode of Science Faction?
They have three colors. If they have three colors, they're...
Tricolor?
That's what I heard. I don't know if it's true.
The pattern we now consider tabby cats, that kind of splotchy pattern, that didn't arise until the Middle Ages. And before then, essentially all... And that was a genetic mutation. Before then, all the cats were these striped cats.
How many
maybe
tabby
some
cats?
Solid-colored cats.
How many tabby cats were burned as witches then, as this do?
Well, one of the ideas is...
Only the black ones.
This... One of the ideas is that the tabby cat mutation was able to spread so easily because they didn't care so much about what the cats looked like. If they did, they would have bred for a specific look like we did with dogs later on. So this indicates that really, while they were domesticated and allowed in the houses and stuff, it wasn't done in the same way we did with dogs, where we were super concerned about their appearance. We were more just like, oh, that's the thing that lives out there. I don't give a fuck if it's spotted or striped or whatever. Just eat the goddamn mice.
Do you think if we took a more hands-on approach to cat breeding, we'd have a better animal to work with right now?
Maybe, like calmer cats. Like what the Russians did with foxes, where they domesticated foxes over like 60 years of just breeding the nice ones with each other, we could have nice cats.
I'd like to think that's just how much better any species of dog is. You could take the most feral species of dog and within 60 years have them do better than like 10,000 years of cat evolution.
There's so many cat lovers out there that are hating this right now, and I get it, totally fine. We were talking shit about cats. Let me just remind you, though. They say that having a cat that you allow to go outdoors, even if it's not a fully outdoor cat, one that you allow to go outdoors, is one of the more environmentally damaging things you can do. So before you get too mad, just remember, your cat, every time it goes outside, essentially commits a massive genocide against the lizard, mouse, and other small animal population.
But you want them to do it with the
mice.
No.
Well, we don't want them to go off into the hills and do it, right? So that's the problem, is they're not doing it at home. They're going off and killing small birds, small lizards, and they just demolish it. We figured it out by attaching tiny little cameras to cat collars, domesticated cat collars, and we saw that they just trashed the local ecosystem.
If you live in Mariposa County, so around Yosemite National Park, you can't have an outdoor cat. You will be fined because like these years of outdoor cat ownership have decimated entire populations of species.
Yeah, and they actually kill a lot of birds and stuff, like especially in the nest. And
we bred aliens. We bred,
it's part of the ecosystem, Seb.
We bred a 10
pound. The ecosystem evolves. Some animals go extinct. Actually, most of them do.
You're right, but they happen usually over slow times, and we have mass extinctions that happen very quickly, like we're having now.
Those happen too.
Right, but then you have the ability for radiation to take over because you still have those natural environments in which animals can go into. We don't really have that, and that selective kill-off, that die-off that's happening very quickly,
it's usually mouse, very bad. Evolve or die.
Yeah.
I mean, you have large enough population.
Listen, bird eggs, what are you doing sitting there being lazy, not hatching and flying yet?
Put your nest in a better place. You're a stupid bird. You don't deserve to live.
All right, condors, you were almost killed by Johnny fucking Cash.
That's a true story.
You deserve to be off this planet, condors.
True story. Johnny Cash once wiped out 50% of the world's population of condors.
The man in black.
All right, let's move right on to article number 2, why starting school early might be bad for kids. Interesting article that looked at the effect of what happens when kids are younger in class. So we're not talking about starting school early like you're putting them in a year early, though that would apply to this as well. We're talking about people who are on the younger spectrum. So obviously there has to be some cutoff date for kindergarten or first grade.
Is this just being young in class or starting early?
No, this is being, well, I mean, you're kind of consider them the same. So
no, because some people might start, let's say they all start at 4, but then some people skip.
So this particular study looked at one year grade level, so they're your standard.
Oh, you mean like kids who were born in the summer? Which grade do they go in?
Right.
I was born 4 hours after the cutoff date for California. I was born on December 1st.
Right.
And so I am probably one of the youngest students or oldest students in my grade year because I could have gone either way, but 4 hours.
Right. So if you are born in the if you are born on one side of that line or the other, you're either very young or very old in your grade. Now, that has a lot of effects that we've seen in other ways, but what this study is looking at is mental health. And what they found is a slight correlation. Now, this should be really emphasized. This is not a super strong correlation. It's not a huge effect.
It doesn't imply causation.
No. It is statistically significant.
Like mental health?
But it's very, very small.
Like your son's not exhibiting bipolar at a degree
Right, exactly. You're only eating a little bit of your shit, basically.
that's what bipolar means. Yeah, the feces cramming, son of a bitch.
You heard it here. Flat Earth. So mainly this looked at mental health issues. They've also shown on other studies some other issues that can crop up. So the way they did this study is they investigated more than 2,000 children across 80 primary schools in England and found that children who are younger than their peers when they start school are more likely to develop poor mental health as rated by their parents and their teachers. The researchers also explored the impact of starting school early on the child's happiness level and behavior, and this in previous studies has shown a negative correlation. So younger you are, the more unhappy you are in these circumstances. This one did not show that, and one of the reasons they suggested is these are very kind of, you'd call them high-end schools with a lot of facilities, a lot of teachers, counselors, that kind of stuff. So they think maybe that gets mitigated out a little bit by that effect, and that might also mean, you know, that small mental health effect you see might be bigger in schools with more pronounced differences. Now, why might this be happening? Think of what happens when you're slightly older or slightly younger. We are so accustomed as adults to thinking, oh, that person's 32, that person's 36, mm-hmm. same difference.
Well, not when you're a kid.
That's a year of growth and like size amongst a small amongst a community of young boys is huge. Like it determines who's getting punched, who's not getting punched.
Well, that's exactly the thing. That difference is so pronounced at that level, not just physically, which we all know. We've all seen, you know, sometimes the difference between an 11 and a 12-year-old can be 6 inches, right? But not only that, but mentally, the ability to mentally process things, the ability to perform certain tasks. We talked before about certain tests that literally between the age of 3 and 4, one day a child can't do this test because they can't conceptualize things outside of the concrete world, and the other day they can.
But so what happens to the parents who have to be told your kid is not special?
Well, what they should do is hold their kid back a year so that he can then be special the next year around.
But then that makes the parents feel bad.
Well, you know, let's just say he's still a shitty student after that. He'll be bigger in sports.
Right.
And at least they can like kind of compensate that.
Well, and that ties into some other research that I'd like to bring in here, which is Malcolm Gladwell famously writes about this. Now, I have some issues with a lot of what Malcolm Gladwell writes, and I think he oversimplifies a lot of things and stuff. But in this particular case, he looks at the effect of that age difference when you're whether you're young or old within the peers of your grade on sports. And he's actually determined that for certain sports like professional hockey, almost all the people, or a vast majority of them, are born within a certain few months because it makes them the oldest people in their peer group grade.
Well, there might be another explanation.
There could be.
They usually play hockey in northern countries.
Yep.
And it might be that people are more prone to breeding at certain times of the year.
True, except for the population itself doesn't show the same difference. So you would then have...
But most good professional hockey players come from northern countries.
Yes,
so you'll have a higher percentage from whatever
but what I'm saying
month
is
they breed
then,
over there.
Then Canada would also, as a whole, have more people born in those months.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's not the
but
case.
But it doesn't?
No.
Really? He checked that?
Of course he's going to check the distribution.
Listen, I'm not a Scandinavian. I'm not even Nordic. But I know that I would be offended if you compared Canadians to Scandinavians.
That's true.
Different people, different quality. Much more polite.
But basically, he looked at it and said, this makes a huge difference, and the reason why kind of makes sense, which is those differences we talk about, especially in those ages like 11, 12, 13, when puberty starts hitting in, there's a real big difference between even a one-year age difference in those boys. And so being able to dominate at that level would help you be better. And so those of you who are thinking might go, okay, that makes sense, but wouldn't that just kind of catch up?
I think that's socially constructed. Puberty
age?
Is a social construction.
Just like gravity.
Well, going to your point about like let's just say I'd been born 4 hours earlier.
Right.
I would have been the youngest kid in my grade. And I might not have been as great in football, which means I would have far fewer concussions.
Yes.
Which means that I would probably be more successful at this stage of my life. So I don't know that this
But here's the thing. So you might think, wouldn't that all balance out as they got older and then all the kids go through puberty? It doesn't, because other studies have shown that if you're good at something as a young kid, even if you're not actually good at it, if we just tell you you're good at it, you're going to get more attention. You're going to get better at it because you have basically the self-esteem. The coaches are going to pay more attention to you. You're going to basically get the tools you need to get better and better and better. So if you want to reach your max potential and your max peak, you have to be better at a younger age. And the idea is that will then translate, and that's why you have this distribution of, for instance, professional hockey players at a certain age. By the way, the distribution also applies to other sports, and not as strongly. I think one of the reasons for hockey is because it's a seasonal sport, so it also depends on what time of year you are big and good at that sport, but it applies to other sports as well. So what we see is, while you might think, isn't it good to get my kid in school early? We know that, for instance, attendance at preschool and going to preschool really helps future academic performance. That might make you think, man, I need to get my kid in school as early as possible. Maybe. And maybe that's good. Maybe it's good to have your kid in preschool at 3 or 4. But then let him do preschool a little bit more. Make him do preschool 2 or 3 years, because it then benefits him to be older within his peer group class.
At the end of the day, this is statistical.
Yes, like, sure.
If you're looking
it can't
at your
apply
kid,
to everybody.
You got to just look at the specifics of your kid.
Right.
I picture there's a Dominican kid playing on a American Little League team with a mustache and everything, whose parents took your advice.
Right.
And of course, their birth certificate got lost.
Well, I mean, back to Damien's point of, you know, the size difference and stuff. Even think as far as academic performance, one of the biggest detractors to academic performance is like social bullying, that kind of stuff. So if you are on the smaller scale, if you take more shit, if you are sitting there worried about getting your ass kicked every time the recess bell rings, you're much less likely to do well in that class. And so even those physical attributes, you don't think that that would, that, you don't think that weighs on kids?
I skipped a year. I was tiny even for my age. I did fine in school. I know I'm one example, right. But the point is,
but you don't think,
I learned how to deal with bullies.
But you don't think that bullying could would then have an effect on academic performance? Because all the studies seem to show that it does. That kids who get bullied, now it doesn't necessarily mean you have to be bullied because you're smaller, but any that seems to show that kids who get bullied have lower academic performance.
I think there's an effect that, and this is purely hypothesizing here, that it used to be, if you got bullied in school, mm-hmm. adults weren't around to fix your problems, and you had to learn with other kids the social skills of fixing problems.
But even in
now,
that,
you just run to an adult every time, and kids don't know how to deal with problems. But there's always an authority that's going
to
fix it for
but
them.
But even then, in that scenario where they're learning to deal with problems, they're then having to take their focus away from whatever they're doing. You're not necessarily thinking about what 2 + 2 =. You're thinking of, how do I get to the door before the bully does, before
but
I get there,
because that's my problem solving.
Maybe,
still.
but it's also not paying attention to what you're doing in class.
But in class, you're not being bullied. During class, you're
right, but you're still preoccupied with that bullying.
I don't know,
Seb. You're a very intelligent guy. You're the only physicist I know who's not autistic, or you know. So you probably had some social skills as a kid, and you play sports as an adult. So I'm assuming, like, unlike your average person who grew up to be a physicist who probably didn't have the social skills, I'm saying you probably got it a lot easier than a lot of other kids who skipped a grade.
I don't know.
Hold on. Damien and I are going to bully Seb in between these two segments. But before then, let's go right on to I Call BS.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
All right. I Call BS is the game where I read 4 science news articles to my panelists, and they compete to see which ones are real and which ones are BS. Are you guys ready to play?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Ready as I'm going to be.
Yeah, I'm ready to play another scientist.
Seb, you have not been here in a long time, but nothing has changed. Damien has still, in the 3 years of this show, 4 years of this show now, has yet to win a single episode.
Didn't
of
Didn't I
Call
win
BS.
Last week?
Not that I remember.
Oh, yeah,
I forgot. Certainly never beat me.
Not that I remember.
Bobby, you were the scientist I have the best, because you want to be combative with Bobby on every time. Like, it gets into like a power struggle.
Yes, but you know what, Damien? Each day is a new day. Just think, maybe you can win one day. All right, starting with article number 1. A new study indicates that a lover's touch is enough to sync up heart rates and relieve pain. Damien, is this science or bad science?
As somebody with 2 divorces under his belt, I can say definitively that this is bad science.
All right. And Seb?
Well, in your case, I'm not sure you had a lover's touch, hence the divorce.
<That's true. laughs> Listen, if you marry a prostitute, it's the same.
What were the 2 things? It was heart rate and...
relieve pain.
Relief pain makes sense. Heart rate, could see both people's heart rates changing, but getting to the same, that seems...
Like, is your heart rate up, or is it just down
sync.
From its base?
Sync. That's the part where I'm getting skeptical. I'm going to say good science, but I'm somewhat skeptical.
So he's trying to win today, because old Sam would have said bad science and fuck you, Bobby.
Article number 2. CERN was recently embarrassed when they referred to their particle accelerator as a particle ass-celerator 165 times on their official website. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science, but yes, it was on their website, but it was in the erotic letters section, so it actually made perfect sense.
The erotic,
physics letters?
Me and my Asian grad student were working late in the lab.
And neither of us had the courage to make a move. End of story.
Went home and masturbated quietly that night.
All right, and Seb.
Well, it's got to be true. It seems like you couldn't make it up. So it's got to be true.
You don't know the things I can make up. All right. On to article number 3. New research suggests that the manufacture and use of ancient Native American water bottles exposed their makers and users to 10,000 times fewer dangerous chemicals than modern water bottles. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science. Ancient water bottles were loaded with BPAs.
All right. And Seb.
What did they make ancient water bottles out
of? I can't tell
gourd?
You.
A
lead.
I'm going to go with bad science, just because if they were so much better than today's, why did they go extinct?
It's big oil. That's why.
Seb's never heard of smallpox.
All right, that came from the water bottle.
Fiji water, now with smallpox. Article number 4, new research suggests that old people who have more sex tend to have poorer overall cognition. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is bad science, because all the seniors I've been giving dick therapy to have all remember my name, complete change of deleterious conditions.
Damien actually has a degree in gerontology, so that is not necessarily untrue.
Yep. Bachelor's of Science, so I am a scientist as well, which means I should be winning a lot more game.
You should be winning a game once in a while.
You son of a bitch.
And Seb.
I would think that people who have sex have better cognition, but that, yeah, I think it's bad science, but... I think the causal relationship's probably the other way around. It's not the sex that makes you smarter.
Right.
It's that if you have good cognition, people want to fuck you.
Seb's still hoping that that's true. Oh, come on. I got a PhD, everybody. Bone me.
Nobody wants to fuck a forgetful Fred.
All right, let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number 1. A new study indicates that a lover's touch is enough to sync up heart rates and relieve pain. Damien thinks this is false. Seb thinks this is true. And this one is... science.
Bullshit.
We already know that people's heart rate, breathing, and other bodily functions sync up when lovers are around each other. This is really interesting. I didn't know this either, Seb. It has to do with your mirror neurons in the same way that you can see somebody doing something and it kind of mimics in your brain when you yourself do it. When you are around somebody you are very close to, doesn't always have to be lovers, but that's the easiest one to test because it's a very strong relationship. You don't even have to be touching for that to sync up. If you guys are in the same room, close together, doing something you enjoy, your heart rates will kind of naturally sync up. Very, very interesting. But what you can do, and what these researchers did, is they took it one step further.
they put him in a cuckold situation.
it's not too far off. So they chose the woman, which seems kind of mean, but they're like, all right, what if we have these lovers, they're all heterosexual couples in this particular example, we have a man and a woman, what if we take the woman and put her in physical pain? What happens?
How much? Like pregnancy, labor? Sorry?
Not horrible. They're applying a heating element to her arm. And not a soldering iron, but like...
Yeah. They burned her at the stake.
Yeah.
I was picturing more like a James Bond laser situation. Right.
So they let them sit in the same room. They got the couple synced up in heart rate. Then they applied the pain. All of a sudden, they went out of sync. So basically, that pain is causing enough of a disturbance to that woman that whatever that connection is, it goes out of sync.
Actually, it'd be much funnier if John Cena just comes in and just does like a body slam. Like, are you ready for the pain?
So it doesn't cause her lover to get stressed out, too. And his heart rate.
Yeah, he's totally cool. He's just still watching TV.
That was a sweet body slam, John Cena.
When they apply that pain, it disturbs that connection. But then, if they then make physical contact, if the man then grabs her hand or holds her, they reestablish the synced up heartbeat and the pain response goes down. So she feels less pain. One of the reasons this is important, think of the thing you guys just brought up that's also really important, think of labor. It's a natural analgesic to have a person you love and care about, especially somebody you're romantically involved with, grab your hand. So when you see that thing, that trope of the man in the delivery room holding his wife's hand saying, you know, you can get through that, that's actually helpful. It's not doing nothing. You're helping analgesically. Not as much as the epidural, but you're helping.
I'm curious. After she touched her husband's hand to stabilize him, didn't she technically tag him in? And isn't he eligible for body
then
slam
he
now?
And not only that, he can take on Cena one-on-one. Yeah.
Does that mean I could go to my wife and then test her heart rate?
Right.
If it's not synced up with mine, she's cheating on me.
Even better. Wait till the mailman comes around.
And check both of them.
Put a Fitbit on both of them. All right, article number 2. CERN was recently embarrassed when they referred to a particle accelerator as a particle ass-celerator.
Hell yeah.
165 times on their official website. Both of you guys thought this was science somehow. This one is bad science. I can make stuff up, Seb, but there is a story of truth to that. Someone caught this mistake on CERN's website where 165 times on their official website of what should be smart people, they referred to the Large Hadron Collider as the Large Hardon Collider, which is almost as good.
It's better.
Now, isn't it, if you use predictive text, like it learns to type. So maybe just this is a guy who goes to a lot of chat rooms, a lot of online chat rooms about.
It's got
to
be deliberate. Somebody was decided to be play a joke on it.
I think it was more like their web developer wasn't as smart as the physicist behind what was going on, and it was easy typo to make. Or maybe, like you said, it was a autocorrect error.
You know what? If you actually go beneath the Earth where they have their particle accelerator, it's actually huge and veiny and runs like all around.
I think it'd be funny if, like you said, if it was like a fill-in-the-blank autocorrect thing,
if he was hard on
right.
In autocorrect?
So he had been typing in hard on a lot, right? And that's how it got in the autocorrect. And so what if it didn't just replace it with hard on? Like, what if it was like, and later we'll be starting up the huge veiny hard on.
All of it, every time he says come, it's spelled very differently.
Article number 3. New research suggests that the manufacture and use of ancient Native American water bottles exposed their makers and users to 10,000 times fewer dangerous chemicals than modern water bottles. Both of you guys thought this was bad science, and this one is bad science. Let me explain. The natives of California actually made water bottles. They used the
discarded water bottles.
Yeah, right.
Human feces.
Well, it came from the ocean, actually. So the shore, especially along central southern California, a place like Santa Barbara, actually has a lot of natural tar and oil deposits that come out, and they come out onto the beach. You can actually walk along the beach and see
get
these little tar bowls.
Yeah. Wait, that's not a result. I mean, sorry to break the moment, but that's not a result of the oil spill that happened in the 1970s. No. That is as long as time has been, there have been sharks washing up on the Santa Barbara beaches.
And that not only happens here, that happens other places. If you look on the East Coast, there's a whole football team called the Tar Heels. The reason they're called that is because they're from the tar sand beaches. They're basically natural wells that can push oil
up. The ones in California are not a result of mining for them?
There's probably some that are coming out as leakages, but this was also a natural occurring phenomenon. They use this to pitch their boats. They use this to put together, the Chumash would use this when they had plank wood boats to seal their boats up. They also used it to seal basically reed containers to make water bottles, and these became watertight containers that they could take around with them. This is, again, this is before any oil mining. This is before the first white person stepped foot on the property.
They also use it to seal wounds on their pet seals.
Super homophones. That's what those guys are into.
You're the expert.
But it's funny that Damien mentioned BPAs, because not BPAs, but that particular tar also includes polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, which are associated with a wide range of health problems, including cancer, hormone imbalance, organ damage, and developmental impairments. So modern humans are usually exposed to PAHs through the burning of fossil fuel, food processing, and tobacco smoking. During the manufacturing process of this particular water bottle, they took the bitumen, which is that kind of tarry stuff, and they burned it and stuff. They recreated this, the archaeologists in the study. They sampled the air, and they found the analysis of the air samples revealed concentrations of PAHs that were equal or greater to that found in cigarette smoke. So these people were actually causing damage doing that. Now, then they tested the water bottles. What if we filled this thing with water and then analyze what's in the water?
Emphysema.
They did not find any problem with the water. They then saw, well, they didn't just drink it right away. What if we put some water in here, store it for a couple months, try it then? Even then, nothing in the water. It didn't leach out. However, when they put a fatty substance like olive oil in there.
Or a fatty blunt,
it quickly became contaminated very fast. And then
they have olive oil?
They didn't have olive oil, obviously, because they didn't have olives, but they did have nut-based oils that they would carry around. They would also have fat-based stuff that they would carry around. Even milk itself is fat-based. So if you put milk in one of those things, you're going to have the same process. So you had these Native Americans using the native stuff around them and leaching out dangerous chemicals. And we actually see some signatures of this type of stuff in the skeletons of certain Native American groups, especially those that use this technology. The reason I think this is a really interesting story is because one of the things that I constantly have to refute to people is the naturalistic fallacy. The belief that because something exists in nature or was done naturally, was done by ancient tribes, it somehow is safe, healthy, effective, better than our current modern day technology.
People in ancient tribes didn't die.
Right. They didn't get cancer. Yeah, all these kind of myths.
Never were violent.
This proves that it doesn't matter where you get the harmful stuff. The harmful chemicals, the harmful substances, they exist naturally. Just like rattlesnake venom is harmful to you, it doesn't matter that it's natural. The fact that something is natural doesn't mean it's not going to corrupt you, that it doesn't have dangerous chemicals in it that are going to hurt you, that it's somehow better for you.
Actually, it probably means that most likely it will.
Yeah, depending
most
on what
things will kill you.
Depending on what you're using, right? And depending on how you're using it. So this is a good kind of lesson to have in the back of your head. Just because something is natural doesn't mean it's safe, healthy, or not containing dangerous chemicals.
It's not going to get into like the environmentalist head. They have like a religious view of Mother Nature as this pristine virgin.
And I don't even think you need to be. I mean, I consider myself an environmentalist. I don't even think I want to protect the environment. I don't even think you need to be in any kind of strict environmentalist. I think your average person subscribes to the naturalistic fallacy almost intuitively.
Yeah, but the hardcore environmentalists, I mean, they really have this like religious view of Mother Nature.
Right.
They do. Or as the Native Americans call them, maize.
God damn it, Damien. All right, article number 4. New research suggests that old people who have more sex tend to have poorer overall cognition. Both of you guys thought this was false, and this one is bad science. Congratulations, Seb, for once again trampling Damien, beating him mercilessly, just foot on the throat.
Okay, and since Seb actually won today, Bobby is not going to reset his like Bobby has like a Groundhog Day type memory. He resets back to the first day we ever played this game if I win. So Bobby...
Which has never happened. This is very, very interesting stuff, and I agree with Seb. I think there is a difference between causation and correlation in this. I think you can say that the people who have poor cognition find it harder to get laid. Especially because, I don't know if you guys know this, the ratio of men to women in a lot of these old folks' homes is like 1 to 3. So very few men, we know women live longer than men in typical, so these men that do live longer, there's fewer of them, and because men now have access to things like Cialis and Viagra, they're boning all they want. There's a lot of women who want the attention that they used to get from having a husband or having a partner, that kind of thing, because the supply and demand curve is such that there's only one man for every three women, and these guys have access to boner pills. They are slaying it. And I mean slaying it.
STD rates.
The highest STD growth rate of any group in all of America is in geriatric seniors. That's startling. And also, they don't know how to use condoms. They're like, what's this rubber? What? I'm not having sex with an Indonesian.
What do they care if they get a disease? They're going to die soon anyway.
Oh, trust me, they care because they have a shitty immune system, and those last few years can be horrible with a raging case of genital herpes actually obscuring your penis.
Yeah. I have MRSA crossed with syphilis right. going on.
So it is the opposite. The study published in the Journal of Gerontology pried into
a
the
good rag, a good scientific right. journal. All right, it's my alley.
They pried into the sex lives of 73 people between the ages of 50 and 83 using a questionnaire. It asked them how often they engaged in sexual activity, along with other questions about their lifestyle and health.
73 people?
Yeah.
That's not a lot of people.
It's not a huge end number.
They keep dying before yeah. the... Before the...
Right. They 350 started, right? They paired this with the results from well-established other tests and used it to assess memory, attention, fluency, language, all that kind of stuff, and general brain power of older adults. They discovered those who engaged in weekly sexual activity scored the highest results, especially in regards to the verbal fluency and overall cognition. The verbal fluency makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Every guy knows. Talker. Yeah, you got to talk your way in there. On the other hand, getting in between the sheets more often was not associated with an increase in attention, memory, or language.
Yeah, I fuck immigrants all the time. Right?
Unless it's an Indonesian. This all makes sense. Obviously, causation, correlation. It's also not just are you better at talking and stuff. If you think about it, that kind of mental cognition is also a sign of other health issues going on. Those who are more healthy are probably more likely to have sex. It's a big, wider thing. I would definitely put this in a causation, correlation type study as opposed to, hey, this is definitely happening because one independent variable
sex
is causing another.
Doesn't make you smart.
Right. That's yeah. It just keeps you from being preoccupied every time a chick with a short skirt walks by.
Well, dementia and Alzheimer's, you can have it and live quite a bit with it without it affecting your social life. It's right. I mean, maybe minor ways. There is a point of no return where you're clawing at your skin
right.
and you can't verbalize things where, yeah, I could see it would totally affect your ability to slay pee. But like I don't know, I feel like it could be like maybe a manageable case of diabetes for most of the time you had the dementia.
So just the takeaway from this, what you should go out thinking as you're falling asleep at night, is that somewhere there's two 83-year-olds just slapping loose skin together in a gross, disgusting, uncoordinated way.
Like peeling one of them gets off cheese sandwich.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we used to have a joke about that, and I think one of our buddies told his mom, who was a nurse, like told him like why don't 80-year-old women have sex? Ever tried peeling apart a grilled cheese sandwich? Yeah. His mom just like sat him down and gave him like, that's not true. By a lot, like 80-year-old vaginas are that's even more wait, lubricated.
She sat him down and said it's not just, true. As if just, like he really was making a serious point.
Grandma, come in here. We got to show this kid something.
It should be said that he has an older mom and perhaps she was like, oh, you think mama's vagina don't work? Well, let me tell you about mama's vagina.
On that note, thank you, Seb, for coming back for Science Faction 180, and thank you, audience, for coming back where you learned about the Carboniferous period, the origins of the domesticated cat, why being the youngest person in your class isn't a good thing, why your touch can sync up your heart rate with your lover and relieve her pain, CERN's horrible misspelling, how ancient water bottles might have hurt the natives more than modern water bottles hurt us, and why old people are constantly getting it on. Thank you so much for joining us, and come on back next week for Science Faction 181.
Hey, Gladys, have you seen the internet? They got some articles about this large underground hard-on. And no dementia.
You've been listening to Science Fuction. Wait, that's not right.
Hold on, I'm gonna grip. Leg grip. Oh God, what happened? What happened to me?
I hope you don't cut this out.
Oh shit, I just went to curl my leg and just started dying.
That's because of bullying.
Seven pounds.